wake up from a substantial sleep and one more nitya bread, could you combine the nitya dying from the sleep with the nitya dying for the pus?
Yes, you can. Yes. Now, there is a question about bathroom, but that's why there would be the same machlokas. Let's say I go to the bathroom. So I have to wash my hands to say Asher Yasar, and then I have to wash my hands for bread. Now there you have a big machlokas. There many opinions say, and this is how we paskin, that it's better to wash your hands, say Asher Yatzar, and then wash for bread. But the problem there is, because since you have to recite a bracha, if you were to wash for bread, so Miman Efshach, you'd have a problem, because if I said Asher Yatzar, I might be mopsik between the Tila Shadayim and Hamotzi, and if I defer Asher Yatzar till after Hamotzi, that's too much of a hepsik. So that is a problem only if it's a washing that you have to make a bracha for. Now, since when you get up from the sleep, you don't have to make a tila shadayim, so it would be permissible to kill two birds with one stone. Do you see that? In other words, I would not compare it to the Asher Yatzar problem. So it'd be okay. Yeah.
Why don't we use separate toothbrushes, me and milk?
Well, you know, that's not a bad suggestion, actually. There actually is a good reason to do that, because obviously there's milky particles and then you're mixing them with meaty particles. The only thing is, let's identify what the problem is. In other words, let's assume that I get my toothbrush to have meat and milk together, you know, in it. But presumably I'm going to eventually at some point rinse out my mouth. In other words, I'm not going to leave the dirty stuff in my teeth. And generally speaking, we don't assume that live teeth can become treif, so to speak. That's why you can have, you know, I can have meat and milk, you know, or milk and then meat, and we don't say even over time it doesn't become treif. So the point is, if you're asking me the question, is my toothbrush rendered treif? The answer is yes, it is. But if you're asking, is there any problem in using it? The answer is no, because generally speaking, as long as your mouth is clean, there's no tarpus in your mouth. So what you're saying is true, but it wouldn't raise a halachic issue. You see?
What do you mean by live teeth?
Huh? Well, by live teeth, I mean the teeth that God put into your mouth. In other words, dentures may be a problem. In other words, dentures can become treif, and removable dentures have to be kashered. In other words, let's assume I have dentures, and I want to use my dentures for Pesach. I have to take out my dentures and put them in boiling water to kosher them from the chametz. Now I don't have to pull out my teeth. good enough and do that.
You didn't mean like vital or non-vital,
vital. No. I mean teeth. I didn't mean that, but I meant basically, you know, implants would be the same thing. Implants would not have to be kosher either, but dentures, removable dentures, do have to be kosher. Yeah.
I was wondering if you could please tell us a little bit about the history of different nusachs for prayers.
Yeah. This is a very interesting shaila. You know, all of us are familiar with the idea that there are different nusachos of prayer. We have Ashkenaz, Sfard are the most common. There's Eidut HaMizrach, which is different than Sfard. In fact, let me just tell you a little bit of an observation. What we call Nusach Sfarad is actually nothing more than the Hasidish version of Nusach Ashkenaz. And the reason it's called Nusach Sfarad is because when the Hasidic movement began, the Hasidim wanted to incorporate many of the Kabbalistic teachings of the Arizal, who davened Nusach Sfarad. So Nusach Sfarad, like you go to a Hasidish place, or even Kamarna, here, Nusach Sfarad is really just a Hasidic Ashkenaz, even though we call it Nusach Sfarad. Now, real Nusach Sfarad is what's called Eidut HaMizrach, and those are the tefillot. Of course, there are variations on that. Those are the tefillot of Moroccan, Syrian, Iraqi, and there are many, many different versions. Rav Avi Yosef wants to have a standardized version, but he hasn't been able to convince everybody. Moroccans still have their thing, and Tunisians have their thing. And even Nusach Ashkenaz has different versions. There is the German Ashkenaz, and the Polish Ashkenaz, and the Hungarian Ashkenaz. And there's even the American Ashkenaz, which is a bit of a homogenization, and the like. And then, of course, you have things that are the odd man out, the Teimanim, which, although we like to call it just another Nusach Sfarad, but it's very, very different, and Teimanim don't like to be called Sfardi or whatever it is. And then there are some Ot that are largely extinct. There's the famous Italian Nusach of Rome. The Roman Nusach was a very famous Nusach. I believe there's only like one shul in Yerushalayim that still has the old Roman nusach. It's very distinct. He's up in there? Yeah. And then there's some old French nuschos, which were very, very interesting, which are, I think, totally extinct, but, you know, maybe one place in Switzerland and the like. Now, the thing to know about nuschos, though, it's very important to know that nuschos are 85 to 90% the same no matter what. That's the important thing. You can walk into a Yemenite synagogue, and if you know the sitter, you know, you'll live, you'll survive. Sometimes people panic. People go to me, and maybe if you're not so familiar, I'm going to a Sephardic synagogue. What do I do? You know, and again, we have halachos of what to say, and there are different minhagim of shlichos. But the truth of the matter is, 90% is very familiar, so somewhat of a different order. Yes, Berchos Kriya Shema, a few different words here. Shemona Esrei, Tachanun is a little bit of a different positioning, but you know, structurally, we're dealing with a 90%. Familiarity issue, which is very good because the nusach and the structure and even the wording of tefillah is 90% the same no matter where you go. And that's a very important thing to know. One shouldn't over exaggerate the shinuyim that we have in all of these nuschos. Now, the question is, what is the origin? Because here's our problem. According to the Gemara, the nusach, the text of our tefillos, was enacted by a very specific body, and that body is called the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, the people of the Great Assembly. This included Ezra and Nehemiah and Mordechai of Purim fame, and this was a particular time, the beginning of the Bayit Sheni. So that would seem to indicate they did one thing. So that would mean if by definition it changes, either somebody got it wrong or everybody got it wrong. I mean, meaning if you assume a unitary origin for things, then if there are changes, then somebody is deviating from the unitary origin. Now, that's less of a problem, let me point out, that's less of a problem with things like slichos. Slichos is one of the very noticeable differences between Ashkenazim and Sephardim, because Ashkenazim, we only say slichos a few days before Rosh Hashanah, and we have different slichos every day, and Sephardim start Rosh Chodesh Elul, right? That's the one of the disadvantages of Sephardim. So when you decided I want to be Ashkenazi or Sephardi, you got away rice on Pesach versus getting up. Well, here we do it mincha time, but you know, if you're really doing it right, 5 o'clock in the morning, Rosh Chodesh Elul. But Slichos is less of a problem because Slichos is not from the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. Slichos is a much later origin. It is from the time of the Gaonim, after the Gemara. And the Nele Shaykh, different communities, the Chatchila, had different customs. So that's not a problem. But when we're dealing with Shimon Esrei, what's the text of Shimon Esrei? Even if there are minor differences, one might say, hey, what did the Anshei Knesset HaGdola do? So we have basically two approaches here. Approach number one basically says that the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, this is what the Torah writes. The Torah writes that the Anshei Knesset HaGdola did not establish a word-for-word Shemona Esrei, or anything. They established a structure and an order of brachos, and they established how each bracha should end. You know, bracha to Hashem, this and that, rofei chole. And then they elected l'chatchila to each community to, you know, within the structure they were given, you know, develop their own words, their own vocabularies, etc. So consequently, when you have different nuschos, they represent, again, it wasn't originally so much Ashkenaz and Sfarad. It really was more decentralized than that. It was this city, and that city, and that city, and that city, and that city. But eventually, there tended to be what you might call a geographically based homogenization, where all the cities in a certain area, you know, would eventually standardize their nusach. But before that, at some point, it was even more decentralized. Every city had a different, the chazan had a different thing. So that is possibility number one, that there is no official word for word tefillah of Anshei Knesset HaGdola. They gave us the structure and the order and the outline, and they left it to local kehilos to develop the tefillah that was most meaningful to them, and that's the basis. And that which survived represented the different, some of the nuschos that were there, and there were many more that maybe didn't survive, as I indicated. Al-Pi Kabbalah, the Arizal, offers a different mahalach. The Arizal says, Kabbalistically, and there are some problems with this, that just the Mishnah says in Maseches Midos, which is not Pirkei Avos. Midos is the dimensions of the Beis Hamikdash. It's not referring to character. In Maseches Midos, it mentions that there were 13 gates to the courtyard of the Beis Hamikdash. 13 gates. And the purpose of the 13 gates was each shevet, each tribe, had its own unique gate to enter the Beis Hamikdash. And if you did not know your shevet, you entered through a general shar that's called Shar HaKolel. And the idea is, the spiritual idea behind that is, each shevet has a unique relationship with God as an individual tribal unit. So that's why there are camps, that's why there are flags, different missions, Yisachar, Zevulun, etc. So the Arizal wants to posit that there are 13 basic Nuschei Satzfila, because each shevet had its own nusach, which was more or less the same, but there were some differences that Kabbalistically reflect the neshama of that particular shevet. And those which survive are remnants of tribal nuschais. Now, the problem with that is, of course, let's say we're all davening Ashkenaz in this room, let's say. Well, if Ashkenaz represents a particular tribe, well, who says we're all from the same tribe, right? That is why the Ari argued that Nusach Ari was the 13th gate. That's why the Arizal made the claim that he had formulated Al-Pi Kabbalah that Nusach Ari was exactly the right Nusach for a person who did not know his Shevet and the like. Now the question is, of course, what is Nusach Ari? That's a very, very difficult issue. Nusach Ari literally should mean the Nusach that the Arizal davened in, which had Kabbalistic Kabbanas. Now, those of you who know that the common term Nusach Ari is commonly employed for the Nusach of a Chabad sitter. But let me explain why that's so. There were many, many versions of Nusach Ari. In fact, every Hasidish Nusach is a variant of Nusach Ari. That's why Hasidim developed this variation of Nusach Ashkenaz to encompass the Arizal. And if you ever look at any Sephardic sitter, I don't mean Eidot HaMizrach, I mean Ashkenazic Sephardic sitter, you will see a lot of things in parentheses, many, many more parentheses, because there are so many uncertainties. What is the right Nusach, etc. So the Alter Rebbe, the Baal HaTanya, claims that he went through 50 different versions of Nusach Ari to arrive at what, in his judgment, was the authentic Nusach Ari. Now, whether that's true or not is not for us to judge, but that's the Chabad's claim, or the Alter Rebbe's claim, the Baal HaTanya's claim, that his sitter represents the Nusach Ari, but other people who daven Nusach Sfarad disagree with that. They say that doesn't represent Nusach Ari. So those are the two basic ideas of the origins of Nusach. One is L'chatchila, the Anshei Knesset HaGdola left it to every community. The other is that L'chatchila, they were misaking 13 variations based on different Shvatim, and what has survived are remnants of that. By the way, I once heard, and I'm trying to trace this down because I cannot find it inside, I may have said this here before, that some want to suggest this Kabbalistic explanation, some want to suggest for a much more difficult problem, and that is, you raised the Nusach of Tefillah, and that I could answer as I answered that, L'chatchila, the Anshei Knesset HaGdola gave rishus for different variations. But some raised the question about differences in Sifrei Torah. Now, we do like to point out that of all of the tens of thousands of Sifrei Torah that exist in the world, they are exactly the same 99.999%, which is very true. On the other hand, that means there is a difference of 0.0001%, meaning there are some minor differences in Sifrei Torah, how words are spelled and the like. And the question becomes, if the Torah comes from God, and God gave this inviolate text, how is it possible for there to be a break in the tradition? If we assume a break in the tradition, then we're in trouble with all sorts of things, the oral law and everything else. So one of the answers that was given is that Moshe Rabbeinu himself wrote 12 different Sifrei Torah for the day. And it might be, through reasons we don't fathom, that Al-Pi Hashem, these minor differences were put in because different shvatim needed a tiny, tiny little different type of message that we don't even understand the significance of that. So that would be a test to that as well, although, as I say, I have not been able to find a clear makor marker that says that. Okay, so that's kind of the origin of Nusach HaTfilah. Bottom line is, at least b'diyevet, you are yotzei no matter what Nusach HaTfilah you daven. So if you're stuck and you know you can only daven what you're familiar with, you do that. If you daven that which you're not familiar with, you're also yotzei. Now, if you're davening in a shul with a different nusach, so the procedure that you follow is, with respect to your private davening, you daven your nusach. With respect to anything you're doing with the congregation, like kedusha or the answering of kaddish, you follow the nusach of the shul that you are in. Right? So you actually do continue take your Ashkenaz sitter in a Sephardic shul and you know, daven your Ashkenaz sitter.
How is the development of Nusach Sephard not like invention of traditions? It seems like it was pretty clear that's a late creation.
Are you talking about the Hasidic version?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's 100% correct. That's why the Vilna Gaon, for example, one of the Vilna Gaon's criticisms of the Hasidic movement, very strong criticism, was they were mishaneth, they deviated from the traditional text of tefillah in their geographical areas. Well, it's 100% correct. Essentially, thank you. Essentially, this involved a group of people who were Ashkenazim who decided to adopt certain practices of Sephardim. That's exactly what it is. And in that sense, there was a lot of criticism, but, you know, again, it's hard to see. Now, once it's been done, it's now a minhag of several hundred years. So, in effect, it now becomes an official sanctioned minhag. But its original justification was very, very difficult. However, I want to point out, in defense of, you know, just to show that Ashkenazim themselves are not free of blame, Chacham Ovadia, Ravadia says, that's the same problem with Ashkenazim who came to Eretz Yisrael. When Ashkenazim came in larger numbers to Eretz Yisrael in the middle of the 1800s, the majority population of Jews that were here were Sephardim, Eidut HaMizrach. Rav Avadya says they had no right to daven Ashkenaz here. They came to a Sephardic community. They are mechuyev to daven Nusach Sfarad. So Rav Avadya actually says that the importation of Nusach Ashkenaz into Eretz Yisrael was totally illegitimate. So maybe that's kind of the Ashkenaz revenge. You know, the Hasidim took Nusach Sfarad and brought it into the Ashkenazim took Nusach Ashkenaz. They brought it into Eretz Yisrael. But to this day, he basically says, Ashkenazim shouldn't, you know, he's going to tolerate them now because they've been doing it for hundreds of years, but he says, you know, Meikar Adin, Ashkenazim were mechuyev to be Sephardic in Eretz Yisrael, in Olman. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I actually have two questions because one of them is from a friend outside, the yeshiva, and one of them is like a personal question. The first one, if a child is born, right, and from two parents, the man was Jewish, and the woman she wasn't Jewish. But I guess the seed or the egg came from like a bank that like the you know that was registered Jewish. Like the seed itself or the egg itself was Jewish.
Yeah.
Is the child born is it Jewish?
Okay, so this is already a well-known shaila because it happens a lot. Infertility treatments. You can, if a woman, let's say a woman doesn't ovulate, she doesn't produce an egg, so it's possible to have an egg from a non-Jewish donor that a Jewish woman carries, or vice versa, it's possible, which is your case, it's possible to have a Jewish egg that is fertilized by Jewish sperm that is carried by a non-Jewish woman, and the term that goes by surrogate mother, or whatever, and the halakhic question is a very, very severe question, and that is, Jewish status is based on the mother, everybody knows that. Seder, based on the mother, not based on the father. Question is, who is the mother in this type of case? Do I look at the egg, which is the source of the genetic information that is passed from the mother? Or do I look at gestation, the one that carried the baby for nine months? The bottom line halacha, according to Shlomo Zalman Orbach, is that we have a suffix, the oraisa, a suffix. Whether I follow gestation, the birth mother, or I follow the egg donor mother, and as a result, the child is a suffek goy, suffek Jew. Mi suffek, the child needs to have a conversion. Now, a majority of poskim say a little differently. A majority of poskim say that we just follow the birth mother, not the egg donor, and that means if the mother who delivered the baby is Jewish, baby is Jewish even if the egg is non-Jewish. And vice versa, however, if the egg is Jewish and the mother is not Jewish, the baby, or the birth mother is not Jewish, the baby vadai needs a conversion, right? So that's a machlokas. So in your particular question, either way the baby needs conversion, the machlokas would be, is it a conversion which is a vadai conversion, or a conversion that is a suffek conversion? Now let me just point out, that's a very interesting raya to this shayla, from a medrash, which is pretty unusual. We very rarely prove halachos from a medrash, and that is the story. If you remember, Targum Yonis ben Uzziel says that when Leah was pregnant with her 11th child, which was Dinah, she was actually carrying a boy. Right? Leah was pregnant with number 11, and Rachel was pregnant. So according to Targum Yonis ben Uzziel, Rachel was carrying a girl, who would have been Dinah, and Leah was carrying a boy, who would have been Yosef. But Leah prayed to Hashem because she didn't want, because there's only 12 tribes, so if Leah has 11 tribes, that only leaves one son, Binyamin, for Rachel, and that would make her inferior to the maidservants. So Targum Yonis ben Uzziel says, Leah prayed, and what HaKadosh Baruch Hu did was, miraculously, he switched the embryos. This is Targum Yonis. It's a little different than Rashi. In other words, Hashem took the male embryo, miraculously, out of Leah's body and put it into Rachel's body. And Hashem took the female embryo out of Rachel's body and put it into Leah's body. This is Targum Yonis ben Uzziel. So now it turns out, actually, that each one was a surrogate for the genetic egg of the other. Because it now turns out, according to Targum Yonis ben Uzziel, that Dinah is genetically the daughter of Rachel, and Yosef is genetically the son of Leah, and yet throughout the Torah, Yosef is called Rachel's child, and Dinah is called Leah's child. So from here we have a raya, that birth mother, the one who gives birth, is called the mother. You see, that's the raya from the Medrash, and that would be a raya to that second view. Or Shlomo Zalman says he doesn't want to bring a raya from the Medrash that way. And therefore, he says it's a suffix. So that would be. Yeah, you had one more question. You said.
Yeah. I heard this practice called like sun gazing, and it's not a religious practice, but it's basically it's sort of like a health practice where it has some kind of like spiritual or supernatural kind of things to it, but not everybody, you know, talks about it. Mostly, it's a health practice where somebody actually like takes off their shoes, they stand on the ground and they look at the sun for 9 months and like 10 seconds. Added on every single day.
But you have to take off your shoes?
Yeah, you have to take off your shoes because there's like a kind of like a spiritual connection to the ground,
okay,
and to like the sun, which like you could actually eventually maybe not even eat food or something like that. And I saw it online. I wanted to know if, I know it's not the best place, but I wanted to know, if it's something that would be against Torah or something to be considered.
I would be suspicious. Now, being out in the sun is certainly healthy. It produces vitamin D.
Yeah,
that's why people who are inside all the time could have a vitamin deficiency. Looking at the sun, we were told as little kids, I remember, you know, it could be potentially dangerous for your eyesight. But now, if they would be touting something just for its health benefits, you know, go ahead and do it. You know, you can do yoga if you disassociate it from the idolatry and the like. But when you have various practices that are connected to spiritual forces, I think, you know, you're entering a red line zone, or at least a cautionary area, because some of these forces might be connected to Tuma, they might be connected to Avodah Zarah, they might be connected to paganism. So I would have to look into it a bit more. Maybe I'll see what I can find. But I think the initial reaction is don't get involved in it, because you never know where these things lead. And that's really a whole problem generally, although this is not the same thing. There's a whole field of medicine that is very, very popular today. It was based, started off with acupuncture, which is just manipulation of needles. But now there's many, many fields of medicine that are called energy healing. And if energy healing is healing by touch, healing by, you know, forces, manipulating spiritual forces. And these treatments are very effective. They actually work in many, many cases. But, you know, they work by manipulating various spiritual aspects of a person's personality. And certainly Kabbalistically, we recognize that some of those manipulations can come from holiness, and some of them can come from impurity. And externally, you might not be able to tell the difference, but you know the neshama gets affected. So you're dealing with some very, very powerful things here. In fact, it's the other way. I'm not dismissing it as being quackery. I'm acknowledging the possibility that it might be a very real thing, but without knowing the sources of it, you don't want to fool around with things that get into your neshama. That's why people ask me, we'll go to energy healing. And there are, Baruch Hashem, religious, learned people who are now involved in this, that you can actually go to. But somebody asked me, can I go to an energy healer, you know, who's not religious? Now, I thought to myself, I think there's a big difference between going to a dentist who's not religious and going to an energy healer that's not religious. When you have a dentist, when somebody is just working on the guf, so whatever, they're relating to you on the body, gashmi level, alright, so even if they're not broke, they could be a good doctor. But when you're going to somebody who's fooling around with your neshama, you gotta be careful. You want someone that is doing so with kedusha. Yeah.
Does osteopathy fall into the red line category that you just described?
Well, I think not. Well, how do they manipulate what? They're like chiropractors? What do they do
with that? You know, someone will come in with a sore back or tight muscles, and their hips are out of line, and then the osteopath will sit there, like, moving the temples around for 20 minutes, and then it fixes it.
I think it's something to think. It's something to think about. You know, again, you have to delve into it, and you have to discuss it both with a doctor and maybe with a rabbi that's familiar with it. But I think the whole realm of non-physical manipulations to produce health do raise some serious issues. In fact, even something which isn't so spooky, even something like psychotherapy. You know, when you're dealing with psychological therapy. Too, it's better. I'm not saying it's indispensable. One can discuss this, but it's better to have somebody that is shomer mitzvos because they're dealing with your psyche, with your feelings, with your emotions. That's a very different type of thing than just the physical structure of your body. Yeah. Yeah.
Obi, so you said before that these things could be connected to tumo, but I remember when this is one of the things that it's always brought up, you know, the men versus women in Judaism issue that, like, tumah, it's not a bad thing. It's just, you know, like, we're all tumah nowadays. When you say, like, these things could have a connection to tumah, like, what does it actually mean? I'm tumah smeis anyways. I've been to a kever. So, like, I'm trying to understand what's the difference.
Well, yeah, I mean, ultimately, I tell you, I cannot fully explain it either. But powers of tumah are going beyond the technicalities of a tumah meis. Powers of tumah mean that in order to facilitate free will in the world, God gave, Kabbalistically, this is, God gave powers of evil, certain abilities to do things. And that's why there's Bechira, because I could choose to go with God's way. In other words, God, as it were, created, I shouldn't call it a rivalry, because God obviously is above it, but God created at least the appearance of a rival that can do different types of things. And therefore, it's possible for a person to tap into these impure forces. I mean, that's the source of magic, right? Pyro. Pyro's magicians. Now, we believe, now maybe you don't have that today. Today, magicians are fake, you know, they'll say that. But we do believe there was such a thing as genuine magic, which the Torah doesn't allow you to do. Now, what is magic? Magic are these manipulations that come from powers of impurity, demonic forces, evil forces, and the like. So that's what I mean. I don't mean the narrow halachic definition of becoming tameh because you're in contact with the dead, but I mean tapping into the dark forces. Again, you know, if any of you ever read, forgive me, if any of you ever read any of the Harry Potter books, now I had a young son during that age, so I'm familiar with the level, at least the first one. Again, don't tell anybody. But the thing is, but you know, it actually portrays a world, which actually corresponds to what we believe exists. In other words, there are dark forces. There are powers of evil. Now, God is above everything. And we turn only to Hashem. But Hashem enabled these forces because that facilitates Bechira in the world, the ability to choose good or evil. And consequently, that's why there's magic. Or at least when there was magic, that is why you have sometimes Rishayim that are able to do things that look semi-miraculous. It's not that we deny it, but they're utilizing kokos of tumah. That is why false Kabbalah is very, very dangerous. Sometimes it's just meaningless because the people don't know anything, so it's just stupid. But other times, you know, there are people that can do things, but you know, you're kind of imprisoned under their influence in different ways. So anything that involves manipulating your mind, your neshama, one has to be very, very careful. That's all I'm saying. It's you're dealing with things that are real and potentially dangerous. Yeah.
Is there any ayat or story in the Kabbalah or the Torah when a person does something like sun gazing? I mean, does Abraham star gazing really compare to the situation?
Well,
if you do the Shem Shammai, of course, not actually.
You know, it's very, very possible. You know, Aryeh Kaplan, Olaf HaShalom, great, great man, died tragically very young. And I've always had a thesis, you know, he delved into Kabbalah very, very deeply, and we have warnings that to Kabbalah too much, it could endanger you. But he wrote 3 books on Jewish meditation. One is called Jewish Meditation, one is called Meditation and the Bible, and the third is Meditation and Kabbalah. And these, you know, these works, if you're interested, are kosher works, and they're works you can look at. This is somebody who, you know, knew the Torah, knew the Kabbalah, and was able to integrate them into various meditative techniques. And he tries to say that a lot of these things, Abraham looking at the stars and etc., did represent various states of meditation, which brought them into trances, which gave them prophecy and the like. But once again, it's like anything else, you have to know how to invoke the powers of purity versus how to invoke the powers of impurity. And that's not a cheap thing. That's not simply you learn a trick somewhere. That depends on one's righteousness, one's midos, one's prayers, one's overall learning, etc. So if you can do this, a very, very long process where you're with a teacher and a Rebbe and a tzaddik, etc., and a person without Yiras Shamayim, we absolutely believe, cannot be connected to the powers of Tahara, no matter how impressive they are, even if they can tell the future and they can tell you all sorts of things. And there were such people who could tell you, you know, they could look at you and tell you your life story. And we don't deny that as a possibility. See, we're not saying they're fake. But we're saying it comes from the Koach Hatuma, which is a very, very dangerous thing. That's all. So you have to be careful. Yeah.
Yeah, following on from the discussion about different nusachs.
Yeah.
Also combining that with different minhagim as well, like Ashkenaz and Sephardi. Why can't I just pick and choose from different ones? Why do I have to follow a specific?
Yeah, well, it's a good thing. You know, there is a powerful idea in Yiddishkeit that you should follow the minhagim of either your community, where you live now, or your family, if you have a tradition. And that's because we don't serve Hashem as isolated atoms floating in space. We serve Hashem as part of a community of people who come together, and therefore a person has to belong to a community. Now, it is true, I've mentioned it before, that if you're a Baal Shuva who's new to Judaism, let's say, or new to Torah Judaism, so many poskim say you're not obligated to like do what your grandfather did. In other words, you can come, you know, you could even become Sephardic if you want. You know, you could see if you know, you could say okay, but you shouldn't pick and choose, so to speak. You know, I like Sephardic rice, but I like Ashkenazi. You know, in other words, you gotta belong to a community, because our connection to Hashem is the fact that we're also linked in achdus and unity. Now, I have told people before that there are certain things in which you are allowed to pick and choose because they are considered to be somewhat fringe areas, although they're important. I've told people, for example, Selichos. I have told people that you're allowed to do Sephardic Selichos instead of Ashkenazic Selichos, because Selichos is not absolutely mandatory, technically. It's an old practice, but you can do it this way or do it that way, you know, and either way is good. On the other hand, for a core Nusach HaTfilah, one should try to be. Thank you. Sorry to trouble you. One has to be. One has to be. Try to be consistent. You know, it goes back to the idea of kehila. You want to be part of a kehila, and that's very important. Yeah.
But if hypothetically I was to read Pesukim, Mishnayos, Gemara, Rishonim, Achronim about a specific thing, see it brought down in Sephardi and Ashkenazi halacha, and say, yeah, I am Ashkenazi, but the logic of the way it's brought down, having learned the sugyas of the Sephardi way, resonates.
Well, let me tell you this. Let me tell you, there were individual gedolim, and there are, I guess, individual gedolim, who sometimes do exactly that. Rav Yisrael Zalman Meltzer, for example, great gadol. He was a Rav Kutler's father-in-law, but he was a great gadol. He was Ashkenaz, of course. He came from Poland. But there were many cases where he paskined like the Rambam. He just said, I went through the sugya. So if you're a gadol, you can do that. If you're a gadol, I can say, I've gone through all the sugyas, and I think the Rambam is more correct than Tosfos. But I don't think, frankly, any of us are on that madriga. You know what I'm saying? In other words, it's a gadol, Rav Yashiv, somebody who really went through all of the sugyas, could come to a decision what he thought was the right one, and he would be permitted, at least privately, not publicly, privately, to kind of say, this is what I do, because I was machria a sugya. I think it's extremely rare for most of us to reach that type of decision. I mean, for example, a posek like Rav Yashiv, I don't know if he ever did this per se, you know, could look at the Mishnah Berurah and say, okay, Mr. Burrow was wrong on this one. You know, I could never do that. You know, I could never do that. I think none of us could ever do that, right? We might follow another psak, our Rebbe, whatever it is, but we're not going to say, I went to the sugya independently, and I think the Chafetz Chaim didn't get it right in this particular case. You know, it wouldn't be, you know, so we have to be realistic as to what our madreg is. The Vilna Gaon argued with Rishonim. Now people say, this is how we teach kids. We say, you know, we almost make it a rule, like who made up this rule? It says, Achronim are not allowed to argue with Rishonim except for the Vilna Gaon. This is the rule that we tell of, you know, fifth grade kids. Well, you know, who made up that rule? An Achron can argue with Rishonim except for the Vilna Gaon. And the answer is the Vilna Gaon made up that rule. Meaning to say, theoretically, it is shaykh for a person who, if they really, really knew, they could say, but this would require a gadol shebikdolim. And the gadol has to, you know, be aware of this. I'm saying this is not something that even the average gadol would be able to do. You know, in Kal v'chomer, people who are not gadolim. Yeah.
Two famous machlokes in history. One between the Vilna Gaon and the early Hasidim, and then later on, Rav Shach and the Babish. And please, I've heard so many things.
This is a sad machlokas in many ways. You know, Chabad is actually, I've been in correspondence with somebody. He used to learn here. He wants to join a Lubavitcher yeshiva, so we were talking about the pros and the cons of that issue. Let me just say this, that, you know, Chabad has done many, many wonderful things in the world. I mean, there is no question in terms of the Chabad houses, in terms of the outreach, in terms of the Kiruv Rechokim. Many people have been brought to some level of Judaism. Now, you could argue they don't keep them in learning Gemara and this and that, which is certainly a taina. But L'chol Pachas, people have become Shomer Shabbos, Shomer Kashrus, and the like. And they do a lot of good things. They do a lot of good things. They're very warm. They're very friendly. I know that if you're cynical, you say, well, so are, you know, Jews for Jesus. Okay, I understand it. But they do good things. Now, the problem that really has poisoned the well in all of this is really the Mashiach issue. Now, the Mashiach issue is really an outgrowth of something that's been going on even before the Mashiach controversy, and that is, Chabad tends to be more and more separated from the general Messiah of Am Yisrael. It's a very simple example. If you go to a Chabad yeshiva, you will never hear a story about the Chafetz Chaim. You will never hear anything about the Or Samora. You'll never hear about anybody. All you will hear about is the Rebbe and, to a lesser degree, the six predecessor Chabad Rebbes. It's as if there is no Jewish people outside of Chabad. Now, that was Chisorin, but then it turned into much, much, much worse when it was Rebbe's Mashiach and everything else. So Rav Shach thought that this was a very, very dangerous tendency, that the idea of a false Mashiach has been very destructive in Am Yisrael. because shops like Tzvi and the like, and therefore he was very, very adamant that that not be allowed to spread. Now let me say, Chabad in Eretz Yisrael tended and tends to be much more extreme than Chabad in America. So Rav Shach was dealing with very, very extreme cases, and some of the Mashichas in Chabad shaded into something that's even worse, in which they were not just saying the Rebbe is Mashiach, but they were ascribing a divinity. They saying the Rebbe, again, this is only a fringe, a crazy fringe, but they say the Rebbe represents the physical incarnation of divinity. Of course, that sounds awfully like a different religion, you know, which we Paskin is actually a Avodah Zarah for, etc. So this was a very, very dangerous thing. Now, Sir Rav Shach had, you know, wanted to... Well, okay. Don't take Chayram as serious as you might think. Chayram, let me give you an example. You know, I'm going to tell you a little story about, I think illustrates this. You know, Rav Yaakov once had to go on a diet. A doctor put him on a special diet. And he was on the diet for a few months. And then he came to the doctor and he complained that he was losing weight rapidly. He was emaciated. And the doctor said, "What's wrong? Why are you emaciated?" So he says, "I don't know. I've been following the diet exactly." He says, "Oh, that's the problem." He says, "I know that when I put people on a diet, they're going to eat double the amount of food they're supposed to eat. So when I give them a diet, I give them half the calories they're supposed to take. Because I know they'll double it and they'll be living with the diet. You kept the diet, no matter, of course you're starving." Let me just say that the way things work here is that if you put somebody in chayrim, right, you go all the way, so the hope is going to be people will distance themselves appropriately. In other words, if they would just say, you know, don't get too connected to Chabad, people would say, okay, then, you know, they'll get connected. Say, chayrim, so at least they'll keep a certain distance. Same thing with internet, you know. There's a chayrim against the internet. Yor Sameach has a website. Why do we have a website? Why does internet have a website? The answer would be that if the Lashon would be, well, the internet's dangerous, try to keep away, so a person would say, okay, keep away, all right, so I'll just do it 3 hours a day, 4 hours a day, you know, no big deal. Say, chayrim, so I'll only do it a half an hour a day. You know? So, chayrim don't really mean a lot. In fact, even the Vilna Gaon's chayrim, you know, which was a chayrim, I mean, we don't keep it, right, etc. Although I know some Litvaks that claim that the Vilna Gaon's chayrim is still binding. But I think the main issue was the Mashiach's issue and the issue of separating from the general Messiah of Am Yisrael. Now, having said that, though, Rav Shach was addressing dangerous tendencies within the movement, but there are certainly individual Chabad Shluchim that are very, very fine, very, very good, and I wouldn't postulate them as individuals at all. Right? So one has to, you know, just be a little bit careful. Yeah.
What is the reason behind Judaism being passing through matrilineal descent?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because, you know, there's a Ramban in Chumash. The Ramban actually says, before Matan Torah in Mitzrayim, the definition of a Jew was passed down through the father. So when the Reform movement says, right, the Reform movement makes a claim that the original halacha was patrilineal descent and it was changed later, they are in a sense right. That is, before Sinai, it was patrilineal, and after Matan Torah, it was matrilineal, etc. Right? So, now why halacha said it that way is an interesting question. The simplest answer, is that before there was DNA testing, you only knew a person's mother, you didn't know a person's father. Right? So if a woman gives birth to a child, you can assume it's from the husband, but you don't know for sure. It could have been mezana with somebody. So as a result, you could not base status on father, because you don't know who the father is. On the other hand, I find that reason a little difficult, because after all, we do base tribal affiliation on the father, even though you have the identical problem. The other idea is, again, based on the more mystical idea. The Gemara says that before a child is born, the angel studies Torah with that child in the womb, and the angel fills the child's neshama with Torah and Kedusha and Ruchnius and a connection to God. And even though the angel then hits the child on the lip, and the child forgets, but the spiritual impression on the neshama is still there. Now, if we take that chazal seriously, what that is saying is that the 9 months of pregnancy, in fact, that would go back to the idea of the surrogate, that if it's in a non-Jewish woman, that's why the post can say the child is a goy, right? Then we say that Jewish identity is essentially created through that 9 month gestational experience. So consequently, if the mother is a goy who did not convert, the child didn't have that input, as it were. And therefore, the neshama does not achieve its Jewish status. So that might be part of it as well. Yeah.
How far are we halakhically allowed to, I guess, bend the truth in haggling for a better price for items? In other words, saying, like, we don't have any more cash when we do, or something like that?
Yeah, so this raises the interesting philosophical question, which is a question both in halakha and in moral philosophy. And that is a lie a lie if nobody believes it anyway? Meaning to say the following. Generally speaking, you're not allowed to cheat, you're not allowed to misrepresent, you're not allowed to say things that are not factually true, and in the context of business transactions, that is what is called geneva stas, right? Geneva stas is deception. Let me emphasize as well that the Gemara is absolutely clear that the issue of geneva stas applies not only to a Jewish, towards a Jew, it even applies towards a non-Jew. Okay, one has to be very, very careful. You don't make any false claims. Now, the question becomes this. The question becomes, and I'm not going to definitively poskin here, the question becomes that when there is a ritualistic game that is played, and everybody knows it's a game. For example, markets. I don't know if they do it today, but in the olden days when things were a bit more peaceful, you go with the Arab shuk and you would bargain, and by definition, you would always offer a price that was much lower than you were willing to pay, and then you would say, that's all I'm going to pay, and whatever, there'll be a game. And it was expected. And in fact, when you agreed to the Arab price, you would actually say, no, we're supposed to bargain here. You're not following the script. Now, so in that type of stylized ritual, it's like a play act, and then you can say what you want to say. But the emphasis is, if you're really going to convey the impression to that other person that you don't have any money, it's not proper to say those things. So you have to be careful.
Why don't we use the mitzvah?
Yeah, that's interesting. We read in last week's Parsha, there's a mitzvah d'oraisa of Yibum. I'm not really sorry, but no. I would like another one. I'm sorry to trouble you. I apologize. I need to get a whole picture here. Thank you. I apologize. Yes, go on. Thank you. But I'm getting you your exercise for today. Now the thing is that the Torah says it's a mitzvah d'oraisa of Yibum, and only if you don't want to do it is there a ceremony called chalitza. Now, it's very clear in the Torah that Yibum is the preferred thing to do, and chalitza is the second choice, and that is actually why the woman spits at the guy, because you say, you're a despicable person, you don't want to build your brother's home. Now, today, the funny thing is that even if a man and a woman, the man is single, the woman single, of course the woman is a widow, he wants to do Yibam, she wants Yibam, we say, sorry, can't do it. Now the emphasis is, this is really a machlokas among Ashkenazi, it's machlokas in the Gemara ultimately, but it's a machlokas among Ashkenazic and Sephardic poskim. Sephardim actually matur Yibam. The custom is they don't do it today because no one, the Ashkenazim don't do it, but I believe that the last Yibam that we have, she died very recently, I think, a woman had Yibam in 1920. And it's very, very interesting because she was married for many years to her first husband. There were no children. Everybody assumed she was infertile. And then she got married. There was Yibam. And Baruch Hashem, she had 10 children from the second marriage. And she talked about, she just died a few years ago, and she was telling her grandson how she loved both of her husbands, and it was a good relationship, and the like. So I think that's kind of the last Yibama, who just died a few years ago. But Ashkenazim don't do Yibam, and it's based on Abba Shaul in the Gemara. Abba Shaul says the following. Yibam is a very strange thing. Because on one hand, it's a mitzvah. On the other hand, marrying your brother's wife, even if she's a widow, is one of the arayos. It is a forbidden erva. So when it's not a mitzvah, it's actually a sin. It's never neutral. But I'll tell you a story about Rav Chaim Oizer in a moment. So consequently, Abishol develops the idea that if something is inherently sinful, but it becomes a mitzvah, it loses its sinful character only if your kavana is 100% l'shem shamayim, that you're marrying her only for the purpose of doing the mitzvah of yibum, and not because of your own sexual desires or gratification. And therefore, as a result of Abba Shaul's ruling in the Gemara Yevamos, the Rama paskins that bizman hazeh, we are not batuach that our kavana is l'shem shamayim, and therefore we treat every yibum as a potential giloy arayos, and that is why our minhag is not to do yibum. Sfardim, I guess, are more confident in l'shem shamayim, or they don't paskin like Abba Shaul, because Abba Shaul is making a certain cheshbon that it's forbidden unless your kavana is l'shem mitzvah. The Rambam says no, there's a mitzvah of yibum, so good. If it's permitted, it's permitted. Now let me just tell you a neat story about Rav Chaim Moshe Gradzinsky. Rav Chaim Moshe Gradzinsky was Gadol Hador in the time of the Chafetz Chaim, great, brilliant posek, but a person who also was a Baal Chesed, unbelievable Baal Chesed, and a person who really was responsible for all of the yeshivos coming to Vilna during the war. I mean, he saved tens of thousands of people by getting them to Vilna and getting them support and the like. He died in 1940 at the very beginning of the Holocaust, or towards the beginning of the Holocaust. Now, the story goes that he was sickly, and he often had to leave Vilna, particularly in the summer, but he would try to get back to Vilna for Slichos and Yomim Noraim. But one time he was stranded in some German resort, German-Austrian health resort, and it was Slichos. And although there was a minyan, there was a minyan of, you know, simple Jews who lived there, but, you know, he was not, there were no Talmidei Chachamim and the like. And he was very, very upset. He was sad that he was in such a God-forsaken place, you know, an abandoned place without learning, without Talmidei Chachamim, without Sfarim. And he's just wandering around. And he bumps into a Yid who seems to be a Yid from Poland, Lithuania. So he's very happy to at least see a landsman. He says, Rav Yid, it's good to see you. He says, what brings you here? So the Jew says, well, I live in Poland, you know, but my brother was a businessman, and my brother died leaving a widow with five young children. And I thought to myself that, you know, it's not right for a widow to have five young children and be all by herself. So I came here to marry her. Now, keep in mind that not only is there no mitzvah of yibum, but if the brother's widow has children, it's an erva. It is an iser d'oraisa. It's a chi of kares. So Rav Chaim Oizer, you know, is astounded. He says, Reb Yitz, you're not allowed to marry her. He says, so the man says, you know, I don't listen to every rabbi who comes and says, all you guys have chumras and this and that. He says, I want to keep the basic halacha. So Rav Chaim Oizer says, I'm not quoting you a chumrah of the Chayyotam. There's some Mishnah then. This is in the Chumash. The Chumash says, if the woman has children, you're not allowed to marry her. He says, I don't listen to any rabbi who comes along. He says, I have to hear it from an authoritative source. So Chaim Roger says, well, how do I convince you? He says, I have to hear it from Gradzinsky of Vilna. So Chaim Roger says, now I know why Hashem put me here. By myself the week before Rosh Hashanah. So you see, I got a prayer of had a chesed that he was able to dissuade muscle this person from Gilui Arayas Mamish by being in the right place in the right time. So it's actually a Maaseh Joya with Rav Chaim Oizer.
What's the status of wind up alarm clocks on Shabbos? Can you set them on?
So you're talking about a manual, in other words, not electrical, not digital, not electrical. So you really are not allowed to set them on Shabbos because you're causing them to sound on Shabbos. You can set them before Shabbos, and you're allowed to shut them off on Shabbos because the Yisur Durabanan is mashmiakol, to cause noise on Shabbos, but not to be mafsik kol. Now some people are machmir because they do say that you see in the Gemara that there are certain issues of Maris Ayin, that even to set a noise-producing device before Shabbos, may have a makam to be usher, but if you need the alarm clock with tzarech mitzvah, we are makil on setting it up before Shabbos, but you should not wind it on Shabbos. If it's digital or electric, then for sure you're not allowed to do anything with it on Shabbos.
Is there a problem with belonging to a mixed Hashkafa community?
Are you talking about where you live, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, everything is a problem. I mean, there's a problem with that, and there's a problem the other way. In other words, there certainly is a problem. Now, whether that means you shouldn't do it is a very individual decision. The issue is this. The Rambam says in Hilchos Deos, and the truth is we know this without the Rambam, that a person is very much influenced by his environment. That's true for you, that would be true for your wife, that would be true for your children, etc. So when you live in a community where people are not so conscientious in Torah and in mitzvahs, that can rub off. Now, yes, you can be a good influence on them, they can be a bad influence on you, right? Which way is it going to go? You never know, right? Maybe it'll be both, but you never know what's the net benefit here. Perkei Avos says, "Al tamin biatzmecha ad yom mosecha." Do not believe in yourself till the day of death. Right? You never know what's going to go on here. So there are costs, you know. On the other hand, there are also benefits: the potential of kirov, the potential of influencing people. Perhaps you can inculcate within your children a greater avas Yisrael, a love of other Jews, which sometimes in insular communities you don't have. So it is an interesting question. I mean, I know people who have deliberately decided, religious people, to live in Eretz Yisrael mixed neighborhoods because they want their children to see other types of Jews and be able to interact with them and influence them. Most Haredim, let's say, make a decision the other way, that they want to create much more insular communities. So it's hard for me to be miyayetz a person, what is the best derech, other than to note that it is an important question in which there are milos and chesronos in both ways, and one has to make a cheshbon, you know, what is best for their family and what is best for their hashpah. The one thing I will tell you is a teaching that is said in the name of the Chassam Sofer. The Chassam Sofer says a very important teaching that if a person puts himself in a kirov rechaikim situation, where I'm here to bring Jews to Hashem, and he's mechaving l'shem shemayim, Hashem promises him his children are not going to be adversely affected. So if you're moving into a mixed neighborhood because you really actively want to be oisek in Shabbos hospitality and kirov rechaikim, and if your kavanah is really l'shem shemayim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to protect your children. But if you're just doing it because you like a more relaxed atmosphere, you know, that's a different type of cheshbon. You may not have that. No, you're going at your own risk. Maybe it'll be okay, maybe not. So you got to be careful about those things. Yeah.
Is there a difference in the importance of putting effort and money into making kiruv versus perfecting the people who are already Orthodox and fixing their middle?
Well, yeah, that's called kiruv krovim. It's even a phrase. You're makara of those who already. In fact, Rav Weinbach Zatzal, our Rosh Hashiva, used to say, although I'm not sure how. Well, Kraven is even a bigger job than Kirov Rechaikin. In many ways, it's true. Because Kirov Kraven, people think they're already there, right? We think, oh, we're already, you know, Tzadikim and the like. So we live under an illusion there. I would say that Klal Yisrael needs both. You know, it goes back to a lot of those questions about, you know, what's more important, the heart or the brain, right? And, you know, the answer is, you know, you die without either one. Klal Yisrael needs all of us to develop our potentials to the greatest level possible. Now, where does a person go to? In other words, where do I put my efforts? Where do I gravitate? You know, what do I do? Do I try to bring every Jew to a basic level of observance? Right? In other words, I'll try to deal with 1,000 Jews to bring them to basic level? Or do I concentrate on 20 or 10 people and keep on making them to higher and higher and higher levels? I think that each person has to be makir where their talents are, what they're more attracted to, what they're better at doing. I mean, for example, take a great Rosh Hashiva. A great Rosh Hashiva. Now, you can say, well, why is this great Rosh Hashiva giving some real advanced, complicated shiur to 20 people? Let them go out and put tefillin on people, you know, etc. You know, the answer is many people could do that, and only a few people could do what he's doing, right? To say, etc. So there is room in making all of these decisions to look at your abilities, look at your kochos, look at your talents, and look at where your neshama is attracted. Meaning, you can't. It's a big mistake when people objectively identify something as a priority and then says everybody got to do that. The Klal Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu has many, many, many needs in the world, and each person may have a different need that they're filling. Right. So as a result, I think you need people to do both. And of course, let me remind you that sometimes the Rosh Yeshiva, like the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon was not Isaac in large-scale Kira for Chokin. The Vilna Gaon dealt with a small number of Talmidim that he built up into great, great Gedolim. But those great Gedolim, in turn, were the founders of all of the yeshivas of Europe that continue to grow even today. So the Vilna Gaon, in a sense, has hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Talmidim, even though he may have directly interacted with maybe 100 people, in his lifetime.
Why is a person not allowed to marry more than one wife?
Well, Doraisa, of course, he is allowed to marry more than one wife. And again, this is Sfardim versus Ashkenazi. Seems to be a theme tonight. Ashkenazim are forbidden to marry more than one wife based on of Rabbeinu Gershom. Rabbeinu Gershom was the Rebbe of Rashi's Rebbe. So it's two generations before Rashi. And Rabbeinu Gershom enacted a prohibition of polygamy among Ashkenazic Jews. Originally, it was a temporary law that was supposed to expire in the year 5000. But it got renewed. Says that it did get renewed. Rabbeinu Gershom was considered to be the supreme authority over Jews in Germany, Poland, and Russia. And those are the Ashkenazic communities. The Sfardim did not accept Rabbeinu Gershom's authority, and they continued to practice polygamy. However, let me point out that Sfardim incorporate today, and really for hundreds of years, what you might call a private chayim of Rabbeinu Gershom. I think I mentioned it, that when in a Sfardic chasna, if you've ever been to one, you may notice that the ketubah is much longer than the Ashkenazic ketubah. There's a lot of extra stuff there. And one of the extra stuff is that the chasam takes an oath, a shavua, that he will not marry another wife. And if he marries another wife, he's going to pay $1 million ketubah or $1 million shekel ketubah to this woman. So in a sense, you might call this a privatization of Rabbeinu Gershom, meaning they don't have, Ashkenazim don't have to have that because we can't do it anyway. But Sfardim are allowed to do it, and therefore they put it into the Ksuva as a Shavua Chamura, a very solemn oath, not to take another wife. Now, why did Rabbeinu Gershom make that takana? That's a very, very interesting question. It's been pointed out that Rabbeinu Gershom lived in Christian countries where polygamy was forbidden. Goyim didn't do polygamy. Sfardim lived in Islamic countries where polygamy was a common practice, but that's very difficult. In other words, we're just following what the Goyim do. In other words, if the Goyim don't do it, we don't do it. If the Goyim do it, we do it. So the Pashtus says Rabbeinu Gershom saw that as the Doros were getting worse and spiritually lower, polygamy was now inconsistent with Shalom Bayis, meaning to say, theoretically, there could be a structure where a person has multiple wives and he loves them and he honors them and they work in cooperation. But as people got less sanctified, less holy, unfortunately it tended to be a rivalry and a jealousy. And therefore, because of the potential for machlokas and bitterness, he felt it was no longer a proper Jewish practice. And this was the takana of polygamy. Now certainly, the Torah says, even if you have many wives, you have to love all of them, you have to care. When that became less of a possibility, so polygamy had to be banned. Yeah?
I thought what his takana was over 6 months ago.
6 months ago?
I heard
that
like it was over.
I had
this Rosh Hashanah
coming up.
Wow. That's big news.
I heard it became a tradition. I'm pretty sure. I'll look it up.
No, okay, I Okay, if you could check that, I'd be very interested. I mean, you know, not for personal reasons, but I've been the thing is, what the Shulchan Aruch says is, that it was supposed to expire by the sixth millennium, which is the year 5000, and it got renewed. I'm not aware, now some say, the renewal is in the nature of a minhag, that is true. But the notion of 6 months, I'm not sure, it sounds like maybe you're...
No, like 6 months ago, it was a date where you began the last...
So you're saying the expiration...
The last was 4,000 years, that's what I meant.
Okay, I'll check that. Now, you're claiming that even when it was renewed, the expiration of the renewal already happened. I'm going to check that. That's hard to believe, but, you know, I'll check it, yeah.
I've heard that when the Vilna Gaon put the original Chassidim in Chayrim, that one of the reasons was because they did like acrobatics in shul. It wasn't like a theological problem yet. Is that true? Was it a theological thing, or was it a...
There were many, many reasons, and there were actually several Chayrim, some of which the Vilna Gaon signed, some of which he didn't sign. But there were many, many different reasons, and Chassidim had different groups even then, although they didn't have all the different rebbes that they had now. The early Hasidim were called Karliners, by the way, because the first Hasidic groups came from Karlin, although they're not the same as the Karliners today. And some of it involved the idea of changing Nusach, which the Vilna Gaon took very seriously, just changing to Nusach Ari. Some of it involved the fact that they had different practices for Shechita. Some of it involved the de-emphasis on Torah learning, which the Vilna Gaon obviously took very, very seriously, and some of it involved what you might call more bizarre things. They do somersaults, they would do acrobats. There was some idea about a certain segment of Hasidim that serving Hashem with all of your body, right? It says, all of my bones, praise Hashem, meant you jump and you do this and that. So there were such things as that, and that was mentioned in some of the excommunications. Some of them involved very arcane, theoretical, Kabbalistic disputes, which most of us, you know, don't even understand, but they were very big issues, such as what is the nature of Tzimtzum? Tzimtzum is the notion that in order for the list, HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to contract his divine presence to make room for the physical world. Chabad, or whatever, Chassid, it's not just Chabad. The Baal HaTanya's definition of Tzimtzum is it's really just an illusion because God is everywhere. Now, the Vilna Gaon felt to say that God is everywhere and God is everything turns the table into God, turns me into God. And the Vilna Gaon felt that that definition of Tzimtzum was Avodah Zarah, pantheism, and the Hasidim, you know, different with that. So it ranges, you might call, from the sublime to the ridiculous. In other words, it ranges from the most theological, esoteric debates to kind of the most, you know, rough and ready, you know, somersaults and dancing on tables and everything else. So it runs the whole gamut. Yeah.
So this whole concept with the love of our generations on right now, is there anything that we actually think that is the Shem Shemayim? Like, what exactly is the Shem Shemayim?
Well, we basically assume that nothing is the Shem Shemayim. I mean, that's very, very true. In other words, we understand we are in a very, very low madrega. We do the best that we can. We try to do what we can. But we never assume that our motives are pure. That's really unfortunate. But that doesn't mean it's an excuse not to serve Hashem. In other words, what does Pirkei Avos say? Pirkei Avos says, Lo alecha hamlacha ligmar, that even though you're not going to finish the job in a perfect way, you're not a ben chayrin, you're not a free person to say, well, I can't do it 100%, so I'm not going to bother. So we do the best we can, knowing that it's an incomplete, job. Okay, be well, thank you. And, I really appreciate it, thank you.
What is the amount of thought
that
you command?
What's the minimum amount of thought that
a man and a woman have to be
Okay. I mean, more of.
Well, it's very, very good.
Oh, Samsung?
It's even better than the iPhone. It's even more of.
That's my focus on.
Well,